Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. The ongoing conflict in Syria has left more than 8 million people displaced from their homes. Many of these are children. Luciano Calestini is coordinating UNICEF's humanitarian response in Lebanon, where some 800,000 refugees have fled across the border, with a number only expected to further rise. In an event at the Development Policy Centre, Luciano spoke on the challenges in responding to a crisis of this scale and on what UNICEF is doing in Lebanon to help these children and their families.
As Robin said, I've been in Beirut for the best part of, almost a year now. And I was one of many dozens of UNICEF and other UN staffers who were deployed on what we call surge to respond to what is an escalating crisis, not just in Syria, but in all of the neighboring countries. I was lucky enough to be one of the ones who was asked to stay, and I'm the deputy representative of UNICEF of Lebanon, which in UNICEF jargon means the head of program. So the post that decides with the team what UNICEF will do in a given setting. The situation in Lebanon, as you can probably imagine, is extreme and severe as a result of what is happening and what is continuing to happen in Syria. Refugees first started outflowing from Syria due to the conflict probably 2.5 years ago, but in very modest numbers in those early days. And there's been a slow, gradual escalation, which really gained momentum less than a year ago, I would say. 12 months ago, more or less today, there were 90,000 refugees from Syria in Lebanon, and now we're well over 800,000 refugees. So in less than 12 months, there's almost a tenfold increase of the number of Syrians who find themselves in Lebanon with very limited access to services, to security. And it's not just a Lebanon story. You can play that story and that example, that extrapolation out to Turkey, to Jordan, certainly, to Iraq, to Egypt also. And it's a dire situation, not just, frankly, for the 2.2 million refugees that we see today spread all around these neighboring countries in the sub-region, but more and more for the host population who are starting to, frankly, crack under the strain of supporting so many desperate refugees who are now coming in direct competition with host populations to access public services. One of the incredible and extraordinary testaments to the generosity of not just the people of Lebanon, but the government of Lebanon, which is a message we're giving here in a very timely way, is that the borders have remained open since day one, always. And now the number of refugees in Lebanon is equivalent to 1 in 5 of the population, which is an amazing statistic mathematically, but an incredible realization as well when you consider that a country that is certainly not renowned for being the most stable in the Middle East, nor the most prosperous, has been able to maintain a very real degree of stability through an extremely trying 2.5 years. In terms of the situation for children, from UNICEF's perspective, this is first and foremost a children's emergency, without any question. We are aware, and we've had conversations with UNICEF colleagues here, that the crisis plays out somewhat differently in the public space. And it's a crisis of politics, which is true. It's a crisis with a military dynamic, which is true. It's a crisis of sectarianism and religiosity, which is true. But frankly, first and foremost, of paramount consideration for us is that it's a crisis that is affecting an entire generation of children. And that's the lens at which we must look at this crisis through, in which we are advocating all duty bearers and stakeholders to join with us and view this crisis through the lens of child rights. In terms of the impact on children. And I will focus on Lebanon, but just to be clear, I speak on behalf of all the children, frankly, that are affected by this, because the issues are very similar country by country. And I also stand on the shoulders of all my hundreds of colleagues who are working in the half a dozen offices in the region. So I'm not here alone, I'm here with all of them. But in terms of the Lebanon context, 400,000 of the 820,000 refugees in Lebanon are children. If you are one of those children, you have a roughly 10% chance of being in school. We have been able to enroll with the Ministry of Education around in the last school year. In Lebanon, it goes from September to June. It's the European school year. It was around 38,000 children. This year, we'll be lucky to reach 50,000 children. And now, 400,000 school-aged children minus 50,000 children enrolled still leaves 350,000 children that are nowhere. And for us, this is the fundamental and most complex challenge to realize child rights in this crisis is the challenge of education. Simply because the capacity of the Lebanese education sector to absorb this massive quantity of children is not there. If you contrast the number of Syrian school-aged children, this 400,000 number today, with the number of Lebanese children in the public school sector, which is 275,000 children, the maths doesn't really give you much confidence. So our number one priority as UNICEF is to find an immediate alternative to those hundreds of thousands of children who will not be able to access the formal education sector. And we do that through something in UNICEF speak, which is non-formal education, which is essentially being able to deliver a simplified curriculum to a child, which is accessible at the end of a school year and is facilitated or conducted outside the traditional school setting. And in Lebanon, what that means is usually it's in the setting of what we call an informal tented settlement, or ITS, if you'd like to learn a new acronym. We have many of those. And an ITS is a place that is not a managed refugee camp, because Lebanon maintains a no-camp policy for historical reasons. It is not politically palatable to allow new refugee camps to be established in the country. So we're obliged to work on a very mobile, temporary basis in the now more than 400 informal tented settlements that are dotted all around the country, and that are, without question, the worst place in Lebanon where you can be a child, unquestionably. And a lot of the non-formal education happens in tents that are literally put up and pulled down at the beginning and end of every single day, because we're not allowed to maintain any structures in these places. And educators, not teachers, educators who have been trained in the simplified curriculum agreed with the ministry, deliver lessons to children in these classrooms, if I can call them that. And for UNICEF this year, in addition to the 38,000 we will have enrolled, and I mean this calendar year, we have reached another 60,000 through the non-formal track, which is a bridge. We consider it a bridge to formal education. Next year, we're going to have to be far more ambitious because of the situation escalating, and we're looking at around 200,000 children who we will reach through the non-formal route. So the numbers continue to get bigger and bigger, which means, of course, that the resources we need to respond keep growing and growing exponentially. So number one, education. These are in no particular order from this point on. Number two, WASH. Anyone know what WASH stands for? It's a good acronym.
Water and sanitation health.
And hygiene. Very good. Water sanitation. Well, it's two out of three. It's pretty good. Yeah, WASH is a UNICEF acronym, and UNICEF is the global mandated UN agency on water and sanitation and hygiene. And particularly in the tented settlements. This is a key priority for our program because the sanitation facilities are essentially non-existent, and there is a high risk of outbreak of disease, and there already has been in these locations. And that's critical to prevent, not just in terms of protecting children in those settlements, but to prevent the spread of disease coming from there to the local Lebanese host population, because it will become a source of tension and conflict. And so instituting a robust WASH response in these informal settings is vital. And it's very slow, and it's not cheap because of the cultural context whereby every family insists on its own tank and its own latrine. And the reason for that is because, obviously, these are very traditional societies that are extremely private, each family unit, but also because these settlements are not simply communities that have picked up and transposed themselves homogeneously on Lebanese soil. They're mishmashes of people coming from different parts of Syria that are strangers in many cases. So that means that we literally have to go tent by tent by tent, implementing a WASH solution, which includes a water tank, which is filled up every 5-6 days by a water truck, which has to be paid for as well. A latrine, one per family, and hygiene materials, soap, information on how to maintain hygiene in such a situation. And it means that we've only been able to reach 65,000 people so far this year because of the nature of the WASH response. We acknowledge fully that that's not enough, given the numbers of people living in these settlements, which is around 250,000. So what we're doing from now is engaging with the private sector, which we did in the previous conflicts in Lebanon, to get engaged in infrastructural rehabilitation at the municipal level, which brings our unit costs down, because efficiency is something we always look for. We have to demonstrate to our donors that there is bang for buck if donors invest with us, but also because by supporting Lebanese infrastructure, we support Lebanese communities with access to better services. And this is becoming more and more important as Lebanese are becoming, frankly, more and more resentful of all of this international assistance being directed, in their view, disproportionately to the refugee population. Whereas at the same time, many, many Lebanese are extremely poor. And that's another part of our program that we're now taking very deliberate decisions on, to make sure that there is equity across who receives assistance, and that it's not determined purely on the basis of where you come from or your status as a refugee or not, but on the vulnerability of the children in your household or your community. So number two was WASH. Number three, any guesses? Just to keep you all awake, because I can see some nodding off.
Security.
That's not us.
Health.
Yeah, what specifically related to health? What happened a few weeks ago? I don't know if it made the media here. Starts with P.
Polio.
Very good. Starts with P and rhymes with polio. Yeah, polio. I mean, we've been involved in immunization in Lebanon since February in a big way. And UNICEF, just FYI, procures 70% of the world's vaccines. We're the biggest procurer of vaccines on the planet. And we provide procurement services to more than 50 countries for their national routine immunization programs. Lebanon is actually one of those countries, but now there's an additional layer of activity, which is around the emergency nationwide campaigns. And since February, we've been immunizing every child that moves against measles and polio. But 3 weeks ago, the news that we feared back in February came true. Just to add another layer of tragedy onto this crisis, where polio cases were confirmed in Syria, a country that had been polio-free for 14 years. Just another blow to children as a result of this conflict. So immediately with the Ministry of Public Health, we put in place mandatory polio vaccinations at every border point to make sure that we catch every child under five as they come through, plus at the airport. And we just wrapped up the first round of a nationwide campaign reaching 750,000 children under five. Literally every child under five in Lebanon received a polio vaccine in the past 10 days, and we will do it again on the 6th of December. And that includes every Lebanese child, every Palestinian child, and every Syrian child, and anyone else, including mine, present in Lebanon. So immunization, another key priority, and one that we will, no question, continue at least for the next 12 months, because our working assumption now is that every child who crosses from Syria to Lebanon is not vaccinated. That's our working assumption. That was three. What was I up to? Number four. What was number four? Who can tell me what PSS stands for? Oh, someone's heard this before. Yeah. Psychosocial support, what does it mean? Yeah, it's something like counseling. I mean, the reality now is that many of the children who find themselves refugees have been exposed either as witnesses or victims or in sometimes forced participants of extreme violence for long periods of time. And this has an impact on a child as it has an impact on an adult. And we find more and more in conflicts like this that responding to the mental health needs of a conflict-affected population actually has dividends to how decisions are made within the family, to how behavior between family members plays out, to how interactions between peers takes place, and in our case, Syrian to Syrian, but also Syrian to Lebanese, which is very sensitive, given the growing, as we talked about before, tension and in some cases resentment. So we approach it in kind of three phases. And the first is what we call level one, which is the most basic, and this applies to every single refugee, which is access to information, so that every family knows where they can go to receive support. And information is gold when you're coming across the border and you're utterly disoriented and lost. You don't know where you're going in some cases, and sometimes that brochure that says there's a school there, there's a UNHCR registration site over there, and if you come here, you will get a WFP food voucher. It's a lifesaver, you know, and it just brings everything down a notch. That's for everybody. For children who are accessing our services, whether they be in schools or tented settlements or anywhere else, we ensure that wherever possible, we institute or establish what is called a child-friendly space, which is simply a place that is protected and safe and supervised, where children can simply be children and learn to play again and interact in a nurturing environment. And for most children who are incredibly resilient, that can be enough. That can be enough. For those that it's not enough, then we move to level three, which is often clinical case management, which we are engaged in with social workers of the Ministry of Social Affairs. But that's for a relatively small percentage. So far, we've reached over 200,000 children, plus their caregivers, because it's as important to reach the caregiver as it is to support the child this year. But next year, we're looking at, from memory, 440,000 children that will need to be reached with this kind of support, plus another 200,000 caregivers, whether it's their parents or extended family members. PSS, critical. Number five, lucky last. I'll give you a clue. It's getting cold in Lebanon. Winterization, as we like to call it. So there's a massive interagency effort to ensure that particularly refugee families are prepared for what is often a very bitterly cold winter with 1 or 2 feet of snow in many parts of the country. I know it's something slightly incongruous to imagine that Lebanon would be covered in snow, but it is. There are ski resorts in Lebanon. And for UNICEF's part, we are ensuring that every single child in every single tented settlement, which is about, well, we're banking on 150,000 just to build a buffer, will receive a winter clothing kit and winter shoes. It's not the world, but it's something. And other agencies are contributing other things. So UNHCR is providing, for example, heating stoves for households. WFP is increasing its food ration calorifically by 50%. So it's a full-blown interagency effort, and our contribution is clothes in the settlements, plus diesel, which is the fuel of choice to heat schools in Lebanon. And we're providing diesel to see 350 schools through the duration of winter. And that's the five what is UNICEF doing in Lebanon. The where has been slightly more difficult because, as we said, there are no camps officially on Lebanese soil. There are these informal tented settlements, and there are many refugees. Actually, there are more refugees who are not in these settlements than who are. There are 1,577 localities in Lebanon, which means there are nearly 1,600 places with a name and a resident population, 1,600. There are refugees in more than 1,500 of those places, and a third of those places has more Syrians living in them than Lebanese now. So in terms of how we prioritize our program in a context of very scarce resources, we made a decision to go geographically. So we took 3 data sets along with some geeks from the Prime Minister's office, some statisticians, and we overlaid refugee caseload at locality level with Lebanese poverty data at locality level and population, Lebanese population at locality level, and we essentially ranked 1,577 localities from what we believe to be the proxy most vulnerable to the least vulnerable. And if you take the roughly the quintile that is the most vulnerable, you get just over 200, 225. And UNICEF has made a decision that it will focus its program in these 225 and only these 225 because they have the most refugees and the poorest Lebanese, and that's where the vulnerability, we believe, must be the greatest. Because other data sets that are nationally valid are frankly non-existent. There has not been a census in Lebanon since 1932. So data is a very scarce commodity. And we're now migrating our entire program, every dollar we have, into interventions in these 225 localities. Which has been a slow process because it's meant modifying existing partnerships and slowly massaging them into place. And that's the where we're working. And those 225 are spread all over the country. And very briefly, in terms of the how, what we are minimizing is what is probably imagined to be the classic response, which is handing a package of something to a refugee family. And sometimes you have to do it because the vulnerability is that extreme. But it's not the biggest part of our program. The biggest part of our program is supporting Lebanese institutions who provide public services to poor people, including refugees, to be stronger. That means supporting schools by rehabilitating facilities, including water and sanitation facilities, by training teachers, by providing furniture and school supplies so that they can absorb greater numbers of Syrians than they otherwise would. And by doing that systematically across the school sector, across the health sector, across the social welfare sector, we respond to the refugee issue because Lebanese institutions can meet demand, a at least better than they would have in the absence of the assistance. We respond to the Lebanese poor because their scant public services are not being eroded by the demand placed on them by refugees. And we meet UNICEF's equity agenda, which is to make sure that every single vulnerable child is reached, regardless of where they are from, what passport they hold, and if they're a refugee or not. And it also enables us to make sure that we leave something behind, because if we simply hand out material assistance to refugees when the resources stop and the crisis is finished, we've left nothing. And we've been in Lebanon for many, many years, 65 years, and it's as important to us to preserve the relationship we have with the Lebanese government, because we'll be there after the conflict, and we have to make sure that that kernel of support is maintained.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.